Welcome back to Behind the Scams. I'm Nick Henley, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Sue, someone who just happens to be my wife. Anyways, if you're just tuning in now, I highly recommend you go back and listen to part one and part two of this series before going any further. In part one, we broke down the intricate digital mechanisms of the $263 million cyber-enabled cryptocurrency theft. Then, in part two, we took a hard, unsettling pivot into the physical world, detailing the syndicate's residential burglary department. We talked about how these criminals escalated from stealing digital tokens to crossing state lines, planting drop cameras in bushes, tracking victims via their own Apple iCloud data, and executing terrifying home invasions. This is a fascinating case. It was prosecuted in federal court in the U.S. District Court for the Central District of California. If you want to pull the filings yourself, the easiest way is to search the public docket sites using a few specific terms: Malone Lamb, King Grevy's, Social Engineering Enterprise, and the district name, CD Cal. Or you can search online using these names as search terms. There's lots of information on this case readily available. Additionally, we will provide links in our description.
That's right, Nick. We encourage our listeners to read all they can about this case because it is truly fascinating. Now, our last episode, part two, was a heavy episode, Nick. It's one thing to talk about data packets and blockchain ledgers, but when we started discussing teenagers showing up at people's front doors with crowbars and zip ties, it fundamentally changed the stakes of the story. It showed that the barrier between our online vulnerabilities and our physical safety has completely evaporated. At the end of that episode, we left our listeners with a lingering question. What exactly does a decentralized network of hackers, social engineers, and teenage burglars do with $250 million in stolen cryptocurrency?
And that brings us to today's episode. Welcome to part three, The Final Reckoning. Today, we are going to walk through how this sprawling enterprise began to unravel. We are going to examine how federal investigators started tying anonymous online handles to real people in the real world. We'll look at how the timeline tightened around key players, what small, seemingly insignificant mistakes turned into massive breaks for law enforcement, and how stolen crypto gets converted, spent, and ultimately tracked. Finally, we'll bring you right into the courtroom to discuss arrests, sentencing exposure, and what it means when prosecutors drop the hammer with RICO charges.
I'm ready for this. Let's start with the money. $263 million. It is an astronomical sum of money. But as we've discussed before, stealing cryptocurrency is only half the battle. You can't just walk down to your local grocery store and buy a carton of milk with a stolen Bitcoin.
Exactly. In my 25 years tracking financial crimes with the U.S. Treasury Department and hunting down fraudsters, I've seen one universal truth. Greed is the loudest alarm bell an investigator can ask for. The theft is the sprint. Money laundering is the marathon. And these criminals had a massive problem. The blockchain is a public ledger. Every single transaction, every movement of a fraction of a Bitcoin or Ethereum is recorded permanently and publicly. If you steal $263 million, the whole world can see the wallet it's sitting in.
So how do they get it out? If everyone is watching the wallet, how do they move the funds without immediately triggering an alert? Explain that process for us.
Well, Sue, they use a technique I referenced previously called peel chains, combined with complex mixing services. Imagine a massive boulder of money. You can't move the boulder all at once. So you chip off a tiny piece, move it to a new wallet, then chip off another piece and move it to a different wallet. A peel chain is an automated process where a large amount of cryptocurrency is rapidly sent through hundreds or even thousands of intermediary wallets. At each stop, a small amount is peeled off and sent to a centralized exchange, while the remainder is sent to the next temporary wallet.
So it's like a digital shell game. They are moving the cups around so fast that the observer loses track of where the ball is.
Precisely. And to make it even harder, they run these peeled funds through what we call mixers or tumblers. These are decentralized protocols that pool together cryptocurrency from thousands of different users, scramble them up, and spit them back out to new addresses. It's the digital equivalent of taking $1 million in marked bills, throwing them into a giant blender with $1 billion of clean bills, and then pulling out $1 million in unmarked cash.
But even with peel chains and mixers, it's still cryptocurrency. At some point, these guys wanted to buy sports cars and private jets. They needed cold, hard fiat currency, US dollars. And just to make sure we're all using the same language here, when I say fiat currency, I mean the regular money issued by a government, like US dollars, euros, or pounds. It's not backed by gold. It has value because the government declares it legal tender and society agrees to use it.
That's right, Sue. And here's the process in plain English. Step one, the criminals move the stolen crypto into a wallet they control. Step two, they send some of it to a place that can convert it, usually a centralized exchange or a broker. Step three, they sell the crypto for dollars. Step four, they try to withdraw those dollars into a bank account or spend them through a debit card connected to that exchange. That last step, touching the banking system, is where the digital world collides with real-world identity, paperwork, and surveillance. And that is the choke point. That is the moment every financial investigator waits for. We call it the off-ramp. To convert crypto to cash, you eventually have to interact with a centralized exchange. Places like Coinbase, Kraken, or Binance. And legitimate exchanges operate under strict KYC and AML laws. Know your customer and anti-money laundering.
Which means to get the cash, you have to provide a name, a government ID, a social security number, and a linked bank account.
Right. Now, sophisticated syndicates don't use their own IDs. They use money mules or stolen identities. But in this case, the sheer volume of money they were trying to move required massive infrastructure. And the hubris of the ringleaders, specifically Malone Lamb, operating under the handle King Greaves, and his associates like Goth Ferrari, meant they started getting sloppy. They wanted the money fast and they wanted to spend it loudly. And here's the part that still amazes me. Back in my early law enforcement days, you were chasing paper, bank statements, deposit slips, handwritten ledgers, maybe a faxed subpoena if you were lucky. Now, the system generates a digital breadcrumb trail automatically. Logins, devices, IP addresses, withdrawal destinations, timestamps, sometimes down to the minute. Criminals think crypto is invisible, but the moment they hit that off-ramp, it's like walking into a building with cameras on every door.
Let's talk about that spending. Because the lifestyle these guys lived is almost cartoonish. We are talking about kids in their late teens and early 20s who suddenly had the GDP of a small island nation at their disposal.
It is a classic criminal archetype. The illusion of the untouchable mastermind always breaks down in the VIP section of a nightclub. Lamb and his co-conspirators rented sprawling multi-million dollar mansions in Miami and Los Angeles. They weren't just buying cars, they were buying fleets. The indictment lists 28 exotic vehicles. We're talking customized Lamborghinis, Ferraris, high-end Porsches. They were dropping $500,000 on a single bar tab at Miami nightclubs. They were flying private everywhere they went, buying designer jewelry, luxury handbags, and custom watches.
I read a detail in the DOJ press release that honestly made me laugh out loud. When federal agents finally raided one of their properties, they found hundreds of thousands of dollars in bulk banded cash, physically stuffed inside Squishmallow stuffed animals.
It's surreal, isn't it? But it perfectly highlights the cognitive dissonance of modern cybercrime. You have individuals with the technical sophistication to bypass enterprise-grade security protocols, socially engineer corporate help desks, and launder funds across international borders. But at the end of the day, they are still just kids hiding their illicit cash and plush toys.
But this flashy lifestyle, it has to be what brought them down, right? You can hide behind a Discord handle, but you can't hide a neon green Lamborghini in South Beach.
Exactly. And this is how federal investigations are built. It's a process of working backward from the physical footprint into the digital ether. Federal investigators, particularly the FBI and the Secret Service, who spearheaded this task force, love a flashy target. Every time Lam bought a car, there was a paper trail, a dealership receipt, a wire transfer, an insurance policy, a DMV registration. Every time they rented a private jet, a manifest was created.
So how do they connect the guy signing the lease on the Miami mansion to the guy typing commands as King Greavies in a dark room?
It comes down to OPSEC, operational security, or in their case, the catastrophic failure of it. These guys were incredibly arrogant. They believed their own myth. They hung out in exclusive gaming servers and private Telegram groups, bragging about their scores. They posted photos of their jewelry and their cars. They posted screenshots of their crypto wallets.
They were literally handing law enforcement the puzzle pieces.
They were. Meanwhile, investigators are using advanced blockchain analytics firms, companies like Chainalysis, to follow those peel chains we talked about. Despite the tumblers, the analytics software is incredibly advanced. It uses pattern recognition to trace the funds. Eventually, the feds trace a fraction of that $263 million to a specific deposit address at an exchange. They hit the exchange with a subpoena. The exchange hands over the IP address that logged into that account.
And let me guess, the criminal forgot to use a VPN one time.
Or the VPN dropped its connection for 3 seconds while they were logging in, exposing their true residential IP. Or they used a burner email address for the exchange, but accidentally used the same burner email to order an Uber to their Miami mansion. This is what people don't understand about digital forensics. You can be perfect 99.9% of the time. Law enforcement only needs you to be lazy once. One reused password, one overlapping IP address, one boasting photo on Discord where you can see the reflection of a street sign in the window.
So the feds get the true IP address. They subpoena the internet service provider, and suddenly they have a physical address. They sit outside, they watch the mansion, they see the Lamborghinis, and they put a name to the handle.
And once they have the name, they don't just kick the door in immediately. They sit back and map the network. They get Title III wiretaps. They monitor the Discord channels. They watch the network talk to each other. They identify the hackers stealing the seed phrases, the callers doing the social engineering, the launderers washing the money, and the physical crews kicking in the doors in California. They build a spider web.
Hold on. When you say Title III wiretaps, what does that mean for a regular person listening? Is that just a fancy word for tapping someone's phone?
Great question. Title III is shorthand for the Federal Wiretap Act, the law that governs when the government can intercept the content of communications, like phone calls and certain electronic communications. It's not the feds just decide to listen. Investigators have to apply to a federal judge with a sworn affidavit, show probable cause, and, this is key, show necessity, meaning normal investigative tools either already failed, would be too dangerous, or aren't likely to work. And even when it's approved, it comes with strict guardrails. It's limited in time, it's limited in what's authorized, and agents have to follow minimization rules. Basically, they're required to avoid listening to irrelevant private conversations as much as practical. And speaking from experience, Over the years, Title III was one of the most powerful tools we had in complex cases because it lets you hear the coordination in real time. In the financial crime world, you might have a stack of records, bank wires, cash deposits, shell companies, and you can suspect what's happening, but the wiretap can confirm who is giving orders, who is moving the money, and how they react when something goes wrong. It also helps investigators prioritize targets, corroborate what the documents show, and build a case that ties the whole enterprise together, especially when people are hiding behind nicknames, burner phones, and layers of intermediaries.
Which leads us to the takedown. When they finally moved, they arrested 12 individuals. And they didn't just hit them with basic theft or wire fraud charges. You mentioned RICO in our pre-show notes. What does that actually mean for these defendants?
RICO stands for the Racketeer, Influenced, and Corrupt Organizations Act. It is the nuclear option in a federal prosecutor's arsenal. It was originally designed in the 1970s to take down the mafia. The beauty of RICO, from a law enforcement perspective, is that you don't have to prove that the mafia boss actually pulled the trigger in a hit. You just have to prove he was part of an ongoing criminal enterprise and that the enterprise committed a pattern of racketeering activity.
So how does a law designed for the mob apply to a bunch of Discord hackers?
Because the structure is fundamentally the same. The DOJ alleged that this group operated as the, quote, social engineering enterprise. It had a hierarchy, it had specialized roles, and it had a shared goal of enriching its members through a pattern of wire fraud, money laundering, and extortion. Under RICO, if you are the guy in London making the spoofed phone call to trick the victim, you are held legally responsible for the actions of the teenager in Los Angeles who kicks in the victim's front door with a crowbar.
Wow, it binds them all together. You sink or swim as a group.
Exactly. And the sentencing exposure for a RICO conspiracy is astronomical. We are talking decades in federal prison. There is no parole in the federal system. You do the time. When you drop a RICO indictment on a group of 19 and 20-year-olds who have never seen the inside of a maximum security facility, the alliances break down immediately. Everyone races to the prosecutor's office to be the first one to cooperate and flip on their friends to save themselves. The enterprise implodes from the inside out.
It is a staggering collapse, from $500,000 nightclub tabs to a concrete cell. But Nick, as fascinating as the takedown is, the most important part of our show, the core mission of Stamp Out Scams, is protecting the listener. We've spent 3 episodes detailing how incredibly sophisticated, ruthless, and dangerous these syndicates have become. How on earth does a normal person, a listener sitting at home or driving in their car right now, defend themselves against an adversary like this?
It requires a fundamental shift in how we view our personal security. It boils down to a harsh reality. Your physical safety now relies entirely on your digital hygiene. The days of using the same password for your banking app and your Netflix account are over. We have to start compartmentalizing our lives.
Let's break that down into actionable steps. Step 1, compartmentalization. What does that actually look like for our listeners?
It means creating silos. The email address tied to your primary bank account, your crypto exchange, or your retirement fund should not be the same email address you use to sign up for social media, gaming forums, or retail newsletters. You should have a dedicated secret email address solely for financial institutions. If you use Apple products, use the Hide My Email feature. If you use a PC, use services like Simple Login. Keep your financial footprint invisible to the public. If hackers breach a gaming forum and dump the user database, your financial email isn't in that breach.
That makes a lot of sense. Cut the link between your public persona and your private assets. What about the accounts themselves? We talked about SIM swapping in part 1, where criminals steal your phone number to intercept your text messages. How do we stop that?
You have to abandon SMS text messages for two-factor authentication. It is fundamentally broken. Stop using it today. You need to transition to hardware security keys like a YubiKey, or at the very least an authenticator app like Google Authenticator or Authy. A YubiKey is a physical USB device. To log into your account, you literally have to plug it into your computer and tap it. A hacker in Russia can have your password and your email, but unless they are sitting in your living room holding that physical piece of plastic, they cannot get in.
Okay, so we locked down the accounts. But in part two, we talked about how these criminals tracked victims to their physical homes using location data. How do we mitigate that physical risk?
You have to ruthlessly audit your location sharing. Our phones are essentially highly efficient tracking beacons that we carry in our pockets. Go into your phone settings today. Look at the list of apps that have access to your location. Does the flashlight app need to know your GPS coordinates? No. Does the local restaurant app need your location set to always on? No. Restrict location access to only while using for navigation apps and turn it completely off for everything else.
What about the built-in tracking ecosystems? Apple's Find My Network or Google's equivalent?
Those are powerful tools, but they are double-edged swords. If you have an iPad sitting on your coffee table that never leaves your house, it doesn't need Find My activated. If your iCloud is compromised, as we saw in this case, criminals use that iPad to pinpoint your exact home address. Turn off location tracking for devices that don't travel. And fundamentally, stop broadcasting your daily routine on social media. Stop posting photos of your morning coffee at the exact same cafe at 8 a.m. every day. You have to stop making your life easy to map.
Let's touch on the crypto aspect one last time. For the listeners who do hold digital assets, we discussed hardware wallets and seed phrases. The victims in this case lost millions because their seed phrases were compromised. What is the ultimate best practice here?
Keep them offline and keep them out of sight. A seed phrase is the master key to your crypto. It is usually a list of 12 to 24 random words. Do not take a photo of it and save it in your camera roll. Do not type it into Apple Notes or Google Keep. Do not email it to yourself. Write it down on a physical piece of paper, or better yet, stamp it into a piece of titanium. Store it in a heavy, fireproof safe at home, or ideally in a bank safety deposit box. Treat that piece of metal or paper with the exact same security you would treat a physical brick of solid gold.
It sounds like a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. Convenience is the enemy of security. But the goal here isn't to become a cybersecurity expert overnight. The goal is simply to make yourself a hard target. Criminals, even sophisticated syndicates like the Social Engineering Enterprise, operate on the path of least resistance. If your OPSEC is tight, if your accounts require physical security keys, and if your digital footprint is minimal, they will bounce off your defenses and move on to the next person who left their digital front door wide open.
It's a sobering reality, but empowering once you know the steps to take. We have covered a massive amount of ground in this three-part series. From the dark web forums where the hacks originate, to the terrifying home invasions, to the multi-million dollar Miami mansions, and finally, to the federal indictments.
It is one of the most complex and illustrative cases of modern fraud I have ever seen. It proves that the old models of crime are evolving faster than most people realize. But education is the great equalizer. By understanding how they operate, we dismantle their power.
Thank you to everyone who stuck with us for this deep dive. If you found this series helpful, please share it with your family and friends. The more people who understand these tactics, the fewer victims these syndicates can claim. For more resources, guides on how to secure your accounts, and updates on the latest fraud trends, visit us at stampoutscams.org. Before we go, Nick, can you give listeners a quick recap, just the big takeaways from part three?
Absolutely. Here's the short version. 1. Stealing crypto is only step 1. The hard part is cashing out, and that off-ramp is where identities and records get created. 2. Flashy spending creates a real-world paper trail. Leases, cars, jets, insurance, registrations, and law enforcement works backward from that. 3. Modern investigations combine blockchain analytics with old-school tools, subpoenas, surveillance, and when a judge approves it, Title III wiretaps to map the network. And 4, when prosecutors use a charge like RICO, it's designed to bind the whole enterprise together and it can collapse the group fast. The takeaway for listeners is simple. Tighten your digital hygiene, reduce your public footprint, and make yourself a hard target. We appreciate you being here. Stay vigilant, question everything, and remember that in today's world, online and offline are no longer separate. This has been a production of the SOS Media Network. I'm Nick, she's Sue. Stay safe out there and keep your guard on alert at all times.